snow crash. In the meantime, he got the raft going as a way of transporting hundreds of thousands of his cultists from the wretched parts of Asia into the United States. The media image of the raft is that it is a place of utter chaos, where thousands of different languages are spoken and there is no central authority. But it's not like that at all. It's highly organized and tightly controlled. These people are all talking to each other in tongues. L. Bob Reif has taken xenoglossia and perfected it, turned it into a science. He can control these people by grafting radio receivers into their skulls, broadcasting instructions, may, directly into their brainstems. If one person in 100 has a receiver, he can act as the local N and distribute the may of L. Bob Reif to all the others. They will act out L. Bob Reif's instructions as though they have been programmed to. And right now, he has about 1 million of these people poised off the California coast. He also has a digital metavirus in binary code that can infect computers or hackers via the optic nerve.
How did he translate it into binary form?
Ing says. I don't think he did. I think he found it in space. Reif owns the biggest radio astronomy network in the world. He doesn't do real astronomy with it. He just listens for signals from other planets. It stood to reason that sooner or later, one of his dishes would pick up the metavirus.
How does that stand to reason?
The metavirus is everywhere. Anywhere life exists, the metavirus is there too, propagating through it. Originally, it was spread around on comets. That's probably how life first came to the Earth, and that's probably how the metavirus came here also. But comets are slow, whereas radio waves are fast. In binary form, a virus can bounce around the universe at the speed of light. It infects a civilized planet, gets into its computers, reproduces, and inevitably gets broadcast on television or radio or whatever. Those transmissions don't stop at the edge of the atmosphere. They radiate out into space forever. And if they hit a planet with another civilized culture, where people are listening to the stars the way Reif was doing, then that planet gets infected too. I think that was Reif's plan. And I think it worked. Except that Reif was smart. He caught it in a controlled manner. He put it in a bottle. An informational warfare agent for him to use at his discretion. When it is placed into a computer, it snow crashes the computer by causing it to infect itself with new viruses. But it is much more devastating when it goes into the mind of a hacker, a person who has an understanding of binary code built into the deep structures of his brain. The binary metavirus will destroy the mind of a hacker.
So Reif can control two kinds of people, Ing says. He can control Pentecostals by using May written in the mother tongue, and he can control hackers in a much more violent fashion, by damaging their brains with binary viruses.
Exactly.
What do you think Reif wants?
Ing says. He wants to be Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look, it's simple. Once he converts you to his religion, he can control you with May. And he can convert millions of people to his religion because it spreads like a fucking virus. People have no resistance to it because no one is used to thinking about religion. People aren't rational enough to argue about this kind of thing. Basically, anyone who reads the National Enquirer or watches pro wrestling on TV is easy to convert. And with Snow Crash as a promoter, it's even easier to get converts. Reif's key realization was that there's no difference between modern culture and Sumerian. We have a huge workforce that is illiterate or illiterate and relies on TV, which is sort of an oral tradition. And we have a small, extremely literate power elite, the people who go into the metaverse basically, who understand that information is power, and who control society because they have this semi-mystical ability to speak magic computer languages. That makes us a big stumbling block to Reif's plan. People like L. Bob Reif can't do anything without us hackers. And even if he could convert us, he wouldn't be able to use us.
because what we do is creative in nature and can't be duplicated by people running May. But he can threaten us with the blunt instrument of Snow Crash. That, I think, is what happened to David. It may have been an experiment, just to see if Snow Crash worked on a real hacker, and it may have been a warning shot, intended to demonstrate Rife's power to the hacker community. The message: if Ashe-Ra gets broadcast into the technological priesthood, napalm on wildflowers, Ing says. As far as I know, there's no way to stop the binary virus, but there's an antidote to Rife's bogus religion. The Nam-Shub of Enki still exists. He gave a copy to his son Marduk, who passed it on to Hammurabi. Now, Marduk may or may not have been a real person. The point is that Enki went out of his way to leave the impression that he had passed on his Nam-Shub in some form. In other words, he was planting a message that later generations of hackers were supposed to decode, if Ashe-Ra should rise again. I'm fairly certain that the information we need is contained within a clay envelope that was excavated from the ancient Sumerian city of Eridu in southern Iraq 10 years ago. Eridu was the seat of Enki. In other words, Enki was the local N of Eridu, and the temple of Eridu contained his May, including the Nam-Shub that we are looking for. Who excavated this clay envelope? The Eridu dig was sponsored entirely by a religious university in Bayview, Texas. Elbab Rifes? You got it. He created an archaeology department whose sole function was to dig up the city of Eridu, locate the temple where Enki stored all of his May, and take it all home. Elbab Rife wanted to reverse engineer the skills that Enki possessed. By analyzing Enki's May, he wanted to create his very own neurolinguistic hackers who could write new May that would become the ground rules, the program for the new society that Rife wants to create. But among these May is a copy of the Nam-Shub of Enki, Ing says, which is dangerous to Rife's plan. Right. He wanted that tablet too, not to analyze, but to keep to himself, so no one could use it against him. If you can obtain a copy of this Nam-Shub, Ing says, what effect would it have? If we could transmit the Nam-Shub of Enki to all of the N on the raft, they would relay it to all of the raft people. It would jam their mother tongue neurons and prevent Rife from programming them with new May, Hero says. But we really need to get this done before the raft breaks up, before the refuse all come ashore. Rife talks to his N through a central transmitter on the Enterprise, which I take to be a fairly short-range line-of-sight type of thing. Pretty soon, he'll use this system to distribute a big May that will cause all the refuse to come ashore as a unified army, with coordinated marching orders. In other words, the raft will break up, and after that, it won't be possible to reach all these people anymore with a single transmission. So we have to do it as soon as possible. Mr. Rife will be most unhappy, Ing predicts. He will try to retaliate by unleashing Snow Crash against the technological priesthood. I know that, Hero says. But I can only worry about one thing at a time. I could use a little help here. Easier said than done, Ing says. To reach the core, one must fly over the raft or drive a small boat through its midst. Rife has 1 million people there with rifles and missile launchers. Even high-tech weapon systems cannot defeat organized small-arms fire on a massive scale. Get some choppers out of this vicinity then, Hero says. Something. Anything. If I can get my hands on the Nam-Shub of Enki and infect everyone on the raft with it, then you can approach safely.
We'll see what we can come up with, Uncle Enzo says.
Fine, Hero says. Now, what about reason? Ing mumbles something and a card appears in his hand.
Here's a new version of the system software, he says. It should be a little less buggy.
A little less?
No piece of software is ever bug-free, Ing says.
Uncle Enzo says,
I guess there's a little bit of Ashe-Ra in all of us.
Amalagin Zabandam Ganunkari Asu
58. Hero finds his own way out and takes the elevator all the way back down to the street.
When he exits the neon skyscraper, a black and white girl is sitting on his motorcycle, messing with the controls.
Where are you? She says.
I'm on the raft, too. Hey, we just made $25 million. He is sure that just this one time, YT is going to be impressed by something that he says. But she's not.
That'll buy me a really happening funeral when they mail me home in a piece of Tupperware, she says.
Why would that happen?
I'm in trouble, she admits, for the first time in her life. I think my boyfriend is going to kill me.
Who's your boyfriend?
Raven.
If avatars could turn pale and woozy and have to sit down on the sidewalk, heroes would. Now I know why he has poor impulse control tattooed across his forehead.
This is great. I was hoping to get a little cooperation, or at least maybe some advice, she says.
If you think he's going to kill you, you're wrong. Because if you were right, you'd be dead, Hero says.
Depends on your assumptions, she says. She goes on to tell him a highly entertaining story about a dentata.
I'm going to try to help you, Hero says. But I'm not necessarily the safest guy on the raft to hang out with either.
Did you hook up with your girlfriend yet?
No, but I have high hopes for that, assuming I can stay alive.
High hopes for what?
Our relationship.
Why? She asks. What's changed between then and now?
This is one of these utterly simple and obvious questions that is irritating because Hiro's not sure of the answer. Well, I think I figured out what she was doing, why she came here.
So?
Another simple and obvious question. So, I feel like I understand her now.
You do?
Yeah, well, sort of.
And is that supposed to be a good thing?
Well, sure.
Hero, you are such a geek. She's a woman. You're a dude. You're not supposed to understand her. That's not what she's after.
Well, what is she after, do you suppose? Keeping in mind that you've never actually met the woman and that you're going out with Raven.
She doesn't want you to understand her. She knows that's impossible. She just wants you to understand yourself. Everything else is negotiable.
You figure?
Yep, definitely.
What makes you think I don't understand myself?
It's just obvious. You're a really smart hacker and the greatest sword fighter in the world, and you're delivering pizzas and promoting concerts that you don't make any money off of? How do you expect her to?
The rest is drowned out by sound breaking in through his earphones, coming in from reality. A screeching, tearing noise riding in high and sharp above the rumbling noise of heavy impact. Then there is just the screaming of terrified neighborhood children, the cries of men in Tagalog, and the groaning and popping sound of a steel fishing trawler collapsing under the pressure of the sea.
What was that?
YT says. Meteorite, Hero says.
Huh?
Stay tuned, Hero says. I think I just got into a Gatling gun duel.
Are you going to sign off?
Just shut up for a second. This neighborhood is U-shaped, built around a sort of cove in the raft where half a dozen rusty old fishing boats are tied up. A floating pier, pieced together from mismatched pontoons, runs around the edge. The empty trawler, the one they've been cutting up for scrap, has been hit by a burst from the big gun on the deck of the Enterprise. It looks as though a big wave picked it up and tried to wrap it around a pillar. One whole side is collapsed in. The bow and the stern are actually bent toward each other. Its back is broken. Its empty holds are ingurgitating a vast, continuous rush of murky brown seawater, sucking in that variegated sewage like a drowning man sucks air. It's heading for the bottom fast. Hero shoves Reason back into the Zodiac, jumps in and starts the motor. He doesn't have time to untie the boat from the pontoon, so he snaps through the line with his wakizashi and takes off. The pontoons are already sagging inward and down, pulled together by the ruined ship's mooring lines. The trawler is falling off the surface of the water, trying to pull in the entire neighborhood like a black hole. A couple of Filipino men are already out with short knives, hacking at the stuff that webs the neighborhood together, trying to cut loose the parts that can't be salvaged.
Hiro buzzes over to a pontoon that is already knee-deep under the water, finds the ropes that connect it to the next pontoon, which is even more deeply submerged, and probes them with his katana. The remaining ropes pop like rifle shots, and then the pontoon breaks loose, shooting up to the surface so fast that it almost capsizes the Zodiac. A whole section of the pontoon pier along the side of the trawler can't be salvaged. Men with fishing knives and women with kitchen cleavers are down on their knees, the water already rising up under their chins, cutting their neighborhood free. It breaks loose one rope at a time, haphazardly, tossing the Filipinos up into the air. A boy with a machete cuts the one remaining line, which pops up and lashes him across the face. Finally, the raft is free and flexible once again, bobbing and waving back toward equilibrium. And where the trawler was, there's nothing but a bubbling whirlpool that occasionally vomits up a loose piece of floating debris. Some others have already clambered up onto the fishing boat that was tied up next to the trawler. It has suffered some damage, too. Several men cluster around and lean over the rail to examine a couple of large impact craters on the side. Each hole is surrounded by a shiny dinner plate-sized patch that has been blown free of all paint and rust. In the middle is a hole the size of a golf ball. Hiro decides it's time to leave. But before he does, he reaches into his coverall, pulls out a money clip, and counts out a few thousand Kong bucks. He puts them on the deck and weighs them down under the corner of a red steel gasoline tank. Then he hits the road. He has no trouble finding the canal that leads to the next neighborhood. His paranoia level is way up, and so he glances back and forth as he pilots his way out of there, looking up all the little alleys. In one of those niches, he sees a wirehead mumbling something. The next neighborhood is Malaysian. Several dozen of them are gathered near the bridge, attracted by the noise. As Hiro is entering their neighborhood, he sees men running down the undulating pontoon bridge that serves as the main street, carrying guns and knives. The local constabulary. More men of the same description emerge from the byways and skiffs and sampans, joining them. A tremendous whacking and splintering and tearing noise sounds right beside him, as though a lumber truck has just crashed into a brick wall. Water splashes his body, and an exhalation of steam passes over his face. Then it's quiet again. He turns around, slowly and reluctantly. The nearest pontoon isn't there anymore. Just a bloody, turbulent soup of splinters and chaff. He turns around and looks behind him. The wirehead he saw a few seconds ago is out in the open now, standing all by himself at the edge of a raft. Everyone else is cleared out of there. He can see the bastard's lips moving. Hiro whips the boat around and returns to him, drawing his wakizashi with his free hand and cuts him down on the spot. But there will be more. Hiro knows they're all out looking for him now. The gunners up there on the Enterprise don't care how many of these refuse they have to kill in order to nail Hiro. From the Malaysian neighborhood, he passes into a Chinese neighborhood. This one's a lot more built up. It contains a number of steel ships and barges. It extends off into the distance, away from the core, for as far as Hiro can see from his worthless sea-level vantage point. He's being watched by a man high up in the superstructure of one of those Chinese ships, another wirehead. Hiro can see the guy's jaw flapping as he sends updates to RAF Central. The big Gatling gun on the deck of the Enterprise opens up again and fires another meteorite of depleted uranium slugs into the side of an unoccupied barge about 20 feet from Hiro. The entire side of the barge chases itself inward, like the steel has become liquid and is running down a drain, and the metal turns bright as shockwaves simply turn that thick layer of rust into an aerosol, blasted free from the steel borne on a wave of sound so powerful that it hurts Hiro down inside his chest and makes him feel sick. The gun is radar controlled. It's very accurate when it's shooting at a piece of metal. It's a lot less accurate when it's trying to hit flesh and blood.
Hiro, what the fuck's going on?
YT is shouting into his earphones.
Can't talk. Get me to my office, Hiro says. Pull me onto the back of the motorcycle and then drive it there.
I don't know how to drive a motorcycle, she says.
It's only got one control. twist the throttle and it goes. And then he points his boat out toward the open water and drills it. Dimly superimposed on reality, he can see the black-and-white figure of YT sitting in front of him on the motorcycle. She reaches out for the throttle, and both of them jerk forward and slam into the wall of a skyscraper at Mach 1. He turns off his view of the metaverse entirely, making the goggles totally transparent. Then he switches his system into full gargoyle mode. Enhanced visible light with false color infrared, plus millimeter wave radar. His view of the world goes into grainy black and white, much brighter than it was before. Here and there, certain objects glow fuzzily in pink or red. This comes from the infrared, and it means that these things are warm or hot. People are pink, engines and fires are red. The millimeter wave radar stuff is superimposed much more cleanly and crisply in neon green. Anything made of metal shows up. Hero is now navigating down a grainy charcoal gray avenue of water, lined with grainy light gray pontoon bridges, tied up to crisp neon green barges and ships that glow reddishly from place to place wherever they are generating heat. It's not pretty. In fact, it's so ugly that it probably explains why gargoyles are, in general, so socially retarded. But it's a lot more useful than the charcoal on ebony view he had before. And it saves his life. As he's buzzing down a curving, narrow canal, a narrow green parabola appears, hanging across the water in front of him, suddenly rising out of the water and snapping into a perfectly straight line at neck level. It's a piece of piano wire. Hero ducks under it, waves to the young Chinese men who set the booby trap, and keeps going. The radar picks out three fuzzy pink individuals holding Chinese AK-47s standing by the side of the channel. Hero cuts into a side channel and avoids them. But it's a narrower channel, and he's not sure where it goes. YT, he says. Where the hell are we?
Driving down the street toward your house. We overshot it about six times.
Up ahead, the channel dead ends. Hero does a 180. With the big heat exchanger dragging behind it, the boat is not nearly as maneuverable or as fast as Hero wants it to be. He passes back underneath the booby trap wire and starts exploring another narrow channel that he passed earlier.
Okay, we're home. You're sitting at your desk, YT says.
Okay, Hero says. This is going to be tricky.
He coasts down to a dead stop in the middle of the channel, makes a scan for militiamen and wireheads, and finds none. There is a 5-foot-tall Chinese woman in the boat next to him, holding a square cleaver, chopping something. Hero figures it's a risk he can handle, so he turns off reality and returns to the metaverse. He's sitting at his desk. YT is standing next to him, arms crossed, radiating attitude.
Librarian.
Yes, sir,
the librarian says, padding in. I need blueprints of the aircraft carrier Enterprise. Fast. If you can get me something in 3D, that'd be great.
Yes, sir,
the librarian says.
Hero reaches out and grabs Earth.
You are here, he says.
Earth spins around until he's staring straight down at the raft. Then it plunges toward him at a terrifying rate. It takes all of 3 seconds for him to get there. If he were in some normal, stable part of the world, like Lower Manhattan, this would actually work in 3D. Instead, he's got to put up with two-dimensional satellite imagery. He is looking at a red dot superimposed on a black-and-white photograph of the raft. The red dot is in the middle of a narrow black channel of water. You are here. It's still an incredible maze. But it's a lot easier to solve a maze when you're looking down on it. Within about 60 seconds, he's out in the open Pacific. It's a foggy gray dawn. The plume of steam coming out of Reason's heat exchanger just thickens it a little.
Where the hell are you? YT says.
Leaving the raft.
Gee, thanks for all your help.
I'll be back in a minute. I just need a second to get myself organized.
There's a lot of scary guys around here, YT says. They're watching me.
It's okay, Hero says. I'm sure they'll listen to reason.
59. He flips open the big suitcase. The screen is still on, showing him a flat desktop display with a menu bar at the top. He uses a trackball to pull down a menu. Help. Getting ready, firing reason, tactical tips, maintenance, resupply, troubleshooting, miscellaneous. Under the Getting Ready heading is more information than he could possibly want on that subject, including half an hour of badly overexposed video starring a stocky, scar-faced Asian guy whose face seems paralyzed into a permanent look of disdain. He puts on his clothes. He limbers up with special stretching exercises. He opens up Reason. He checks the barrels for damage or dirt. Hero fast-forwards through all of this. Finally, the stocky Asian man puts on the gun. Fisheye wasn't really using Reason the right way. It comes with its own mount that straps to your body so that you can soak up the recoil with your pelvis, taking the force right into your body's center of gravity. The mount has shock absorbers and miniature hydraulic goodies to compensate for the weight and the recoil. If you put all this stuff on the right way, the gun's a lot easier to use accurately. And if you're goggled into a computer, it'll superimpose a handy crosshairs over whatever the gun's aimed at. Your information, sir, the librarian says. Are you smart enough to tie that information into you are here? Hero says. I'll see what I can do, sir. The formats appear to be reconcilable. Sir? Yes? These blueprints are several years old. Since they were made, the Enterprise has been purchased by a private owner, who may have made some changes. Gotcha. Hero's back in reality. He finds an open boulevard of water that leads inward to the core. It has a sort of pedestrian catwalk running along one side of it, pieced together haphazardly, a seemingly endless procession of gangplanks, pontoons, logs, abandoned skiffs, aluminum canoes, oil drums. Anywhere else in the world, it would be an obstacle course. Here in the fifth world, it's a superhighway. Hero takes the boat straight down the middle, not very fast. If he runs into something, the boat might flip. Reason will sink, and Hero strapped onto Reason. Flipping into gargoyle mode, he can clearly make out a sparse picket line of hemispherical domes running along the edge of the Enterprise's flight deck. The radar gear thoughtfully identifies these on screen as the radar antennas of Phalanx anti-missile guns. Underneath each dome, a multi-barreled gun protrudes. He slows to a near stop and waves the barrel of Reason back and forth for a while until a crosshairs whips across his field of vision. That's the aiming point. He gets it settled down in the middle, right on one of those Phalanx guns, and jerks the trigger for half a second. The big dome turns into a fountain of jagged, flaky debris. Underneath it, the gun barrels are still visible, speckled with a few red marks. Hero lowers the crosshairs a tad and fires another 50-round burst that cuts the gun loose from its mount. Then its ammunition belt starts to burst sporadically, and Hero has to look away. He looks at the next Phalanx gun and finds himself staring straight down its barrels. That's so scary, he jerks the trigger involuntarily and fires a long burst that appears to do nothing at all. Then his view is obscured by something close up. The recoil has pushed him back behind a decrepit yacht tied up along the side of the channel. He knows what's going to happen next. The steam makes him easy to find, so he whips out of there. A second later, the yacht gets simply forced under the water by a burst from the big gun. Hero runs for a few seconds, finds a pontoon where he can steady himself, and opens up again with a long burst. When he's finished, the edge of the Enterprise has a jagged semicircular bite taken out of it where the Phalanx gun used to be. He takes to the main channel again and follows it inward until it terminates beneath one of the core ships, a container ship converted into a high-rise apartment complex. A cargo net serves as a ramp from one to the other. It probably serves as a drawbridge also, when undesirables try to clamber up out of the ghetto. Hero is about as undesirable as anyone can be on the raft, but they leave the cargo net there for him. That's quite all right. He's staying on the little boat for now.
He buzzes down the side of the container ship, makes a U-turn around its prow. The next vessel is a big oil tanker, mostly empty and riding high in the water. Looking up the sheer steel canyon separating the two ships, he sees no handy cargo nets stretched between them. They don't want thieves or terrorists to come up onto the tanker and drill for oil. The next ship is the Enterprise. The two giant vessels, the tanker and the aircraft carrier, ride parallel, anywhere from 10 to 50 feet apart, joined by a number of gigantic cables and held apart by huge airbags, like they squished a few blimps between them to keep them from rubbing. The heavy cables aren't just lashed from one ship to another. They've done something clever with weights and pulleys, he suspects, to allow for some slack when rough seas pull the ships opposite ways. Hero rides his own little airbag in between them. This gray steel tunnel is quiet and isolated compared to the raft. Except for him, no one has any reason to be here. For a minute, he just wants to sit there and relax. Which is not too likely when you think about it.
You are here, he says.
His view of the Enterprise's hull, a gently curved expanse of gray steel, turns into a three-dimensional wireframe drawing, showing him all the guts of the ship on the other side. Down here along the waterline, the Enterprise has a belt of thick anti-torpedo armor. It's not too promising. Farther up, the armor is thinner, and there's good stuff on the other side of it. Actual rooms instead of fuel tanks or ammunition holds. Hero chooses a room marked Ward Room and opens fire. The hull of the Enterprise is surprisingly tough. Reason doesn't just blow a crater straight through. It takes a few moments for the burst to penetrate. And then all it does is make a hole about 6 inches across. The recoil pushes Hero back against the rusted hull of the oil tanker. He can't take the gun with him anyway. He holds the trigger down and just tries to keep it aimed in a consistent direction until all the ammunition is gone. Then he unstraps it from his body and dumps the whole thing overboard. It'll go to the bottom and mark its position with a column of steam. Later, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong can dispatch one of its environmental direct action posses to pick it up. Then they can haul Hero before the Tribunal of Environmental Crimes if they want to. Right now, he doesn't care. It takes half a dozen tries to secure the grappling hook in the jagged hole, 20 feet above the waterline. As he's wriggling through the hole, his coverall makes popping and hissing noises as the hot, sharp metal melts and tears through the synthetic material. He ends up leaving scraps of it behind, welded to the hull. He's got a few first and second degree burns on the parts of his skin that are now exposed, but they don't really hurt yet. That's how wound up he is. Later, they'll hurt. The soles of his shoes melt and sizzle as he treads on glowing hunks of shrapnel. The room is rather smoky, but aircraft carriers are nothing if not fire-conscious, and not too much in this place is flammable. Hero just walks through the smoke to the door, which has been carved into a steel doily by Reason. He kicks it out of its frame and enters a place that, in the blueprints, is simply marked Passageway. Then, because this seems as good a time as any, he draws his katana. When her partner is off doing something in reality, his avatar goes kind of slack. The body sits there like an inflatable love doll, and the face continues to go through all kinds of stretching exercises. She does not know what he's doing, but it looks like it must be exciting, because most of the time, he's either extremely surprised or scared shitless. Shortly after he gets done talking to the librarian dude about the aircraft carrier, she begins to hear deep rumbling noises, reality noises, from outside. Sounds like a cross between a machine gun and a buzzsaw. Whenever she hears that noise, Hero's face gets this astonished look like, I'm about to die. Someone is tapping her on the shoulder. Some suit who has an early morning appointment in the metaverse figures that whatever this courier is doing can't be all that important. She ignores it for a minute. Then Hero's office goes out of focus, jumps up in the air like it is painted on a window shade,
and she's looking into the face of a guy, an Asian guy, a creep, a wirehead, one of the scary antenna dudes.
Okay, she says. What do you want?
He grabs her by the arm and hauls her out of the booth. There's another one with him, and he grabs her other arm. They all start walking out of there.
Let go my fucking arm, she says. I'll go with you. It's okay.
It's not the first time she's been thrown out of a building full of suits. This time, it's a little different, though. This time, the bouncers are a couple of life-sized plastic action figures from Toys R Us. And it's not just that these guys probably don't speak English. They just don't act normal. She actually manages to twist one of her arms loose, and the guy doesn't smack her or anything. Just turns rigidly towards her and paws at her mechanically until he's got her by the arm again. No change in his face. His eyes stare like busted headlights. His mouth is open enough to let him breathe through it, but the lips never move, never change expression. They are in a complex of ship cabins and sliced open containers that acts as the lobby of the hotel. The wireheads drag her out of the door over the blunt crosshairs of the helipad. Just in time, too, because a chopper happens to be coming in for a landing. The safety procedures in this place suck. They could have got their heads chopped off. It is the slick corporate chopper with the Rare logo that she saw earlier. The wireheads try to drag her over a gangplank thingy that leads them across open water to the next ship. She manages to get turned around backward, grabs the railings with both hands, hooks her ankles into the stanchions, and hangs on. One of them grabs her around the waist from behind and tries to yank her body loose, while the other one stands in front of her and pries her fingers loose, one at a time. Several guys are piling out of the Rare chopper. They are wearing coveralls with gear stuck into the pockets, and she sees at least one stethoscope. They haul big fiberglass cases out of the chopper with red crosses painted on their sides and run into the container ship. YT knows that this is not being done for the benefit of some fat businessman who stroked a lobe over his stewed prunes. They are going in there to reanimate her boyfriend. Raven, pumped, full of speed. Just what the world needs right now. They drag her across the deck of the next ship. From there, they take a stairway thingy up to the next ship after that, which is very big. She thinks it's an oil tanker. She can look across its broad deck through a tangle of pipes, rust seeping through white paint, and see the Enterprise on the other side. That's where they're going. There's no direct connection. A crane on the deck of the Enterprise has swung itself over to dangle a small wire cage over the tanker, just a few feet off the deck. It bobs up and down and glides back and forth over a fairly large area as the two ships rock in different ways and it swings like a pendulum at the end of its cable. It has a door on one side, which is hanging open. They sort of toss her into it head first, keeping her arms pinned to her side so she can't push it away from her, and then they spend a few seconds folding her legs in behind her. It's obvious by now that talking doesn't work. So she just fights silently. She manages to give one of them a good stomp to the bridge of the nose, and both feels and hears the bone break. But the man doesn't react in any way, other than snapping his head back on impact. She's so busy watching him, waiting to see when he's going to figure out that his nose is broken and that she's responsible for it, that she stops kicking and flailing long enough to get all shoved into the cage. Then the door snaps shut. An experienced raccoon could get the latch open. This cage isn't made to hold people. But by the time she gets her body worked around to the point where she can reach it, she's 20 feet above the deck, looking down on a lead of black water between the tanker and the Enterprise. Down below, she can see an abandoned Zodiac caroming back and forth between the steel walls. Not everything is exactly right on the Enterprise. Something is burning somewhere. People are firing guns. She's not entirely sure she wants to be there. As long as she is high up in the air, she reconnoiters the ship and confirms that there is no way off, no handy gangplanks or stairway thingies. She is being lowered toward the Enterprise. The cage is careening back and forth, skimming just over the deck on its cable, and when it finally touches the deck, it skids for a few feet before coming to a halt. She pops the latch and climbs out of there. Now what? There's a bullseye painted on the deck. A few helicopters parked around the edges and lashed down. And there is one helicopter, a mammoth twin-engine jet number, kind of a flying bathtub festooned with guns and missiles, sitting right in the middle of the bullseye, all of its lights on, engine whining, rotors spinning desultorily. A small cluster of men is standing next to it. YT walks toward it. She hates this. She knows this is exactly what she's supposed to do, but there really is no other choice. She wishes profoundly that she had her plank with her. The deck of this aircraft carrier is some of the best skating territory she has ever seen. She has seen in movies that carriers have big steam catapults for throwing airplanes into the sky. Think of what it would be like to ride a steam catapult on your plank. As she is walking toward the helicopter, one of the men standing by it detaches himself from the group and walks toward her. He's big, with a body like a 55-gallon drum, and a mustache that turns up at the corners. And as he comes toward her, he is laughing in a satisfied way, which pisses her off.
"Well, don't you look like a forlorn little thing," he says. "Shit, honey, you look like a drowned rat that got dried out again."
"Thanks," she says. "You look like chiseled spam."
"Very funny," he says.
"Then how come you're not laughing? Afraid it's true?"
"Look," he says, "I don't have time for this fucking adolescent banter. I grew up and got old specifically to get away from this."
"It's not that you don't have time," she says. "It's that you're not very good at it."
"You know who I am?" he asks.
"Yeah, I know. You know who I am?"
"YT, a 15-year-old courier
and personal buddy of Uncle Enzo," she says, whipping off the string of dog tags and tossing them. He holds out one hand startled, and the chain whips around his fingers. He holds them up and reads them.
"Well, well," he says. "This is quite a little memento."
He throws them back at her.
"I know you're buddies with Uncle Enzo. Otherwise, I just would have dunked you instead of bringing you here to my spread. And I frankly don't give a shit," he says. "Because by the time this day is through, either Uncle Enzo will be out of a job, or else I'll be, as you said, chiseled spam. But I figure that the big wop will be a lot less likely to throw a stinger through the turbine of my chopper there if he knows his little Chiquita is on board."
"It's not like that," Whitey says. "It's not a relationship where fucking is part of it." But she is chagrined to learn that the dog tags, after all this time, did not have any magical effect on the bad guys. Rife turns around and starts walking back to the chopper. After a few steps, he turns back and looks at her, just standing there, trying not to cry.
"You coming?" he says.
She looks at the chopper, a ticket off the raft.
"Can I leave a note for Raven?"
"As far as Raven is concerned, I think you already made your point." "Come on, girl, we're wasting jet fuel over there. That ain't good for the goddamn environment."
She follows him to the chopper, climbs on board. It's warm and light inside here, with nice seats. Like coming in off a hard February day of thrashing the grittier highways and settling into a padded easy chair.
"Had the interior redone," Rife says. "This is a big old Sov gunship, and it wasn't made for comfort. But that's the price you pay for all that armor plating."
There's two other guys in here. One is about 50, sort of gaunt, big pores, wire-rimmed bifocals, carrying a laptop, a techie. The other is a bulky African-American with a gun.
"YT,"
says the always polite L. Bob Rife.
"Meet Frank Frost, my tech director, and Tony Michaels, my security chief."
"Ma'am,"
says Tony.
"Howdy," says Frank.
"Suck my toes," says YT.
"Don't step on that, please," Frank says.
YT looks down. Climbing into the empty seat nearest the door, she has stepped on a package resting on the floor. It's about the dimensions of a phone book, but irregular, very heavy, swaddled in bubble pack and clear plastic. she can see glimpses of what's inside. Light reddish-brown in color, covered with chicken scratches, hard as a rock. "What's that?" Whitey says. "Homemade bread from Mom?" "It's an ancient artifact," Frank says, all pissed off. Rife chuckles, pleased and relieved that Whitey is now insulting someone else. Another man duck walks across the flight deck in mortal fear of the whirling rotor blades and climbs in. He's about 60, with a dirigible of white hair that was not ruffled in any way by the downdraft.
"Hello, everyone," he says cheerfully. "I don't think I've met all of you. Just got here this morning, and now I'm on my way back again."
"Who are you?" Tony says. The new guy looks crestfallen.
"Greg Ritchie," he says.
Then, when no one seems to react, he jogs their memory.
"President of the United States."
"Oh!
Sorry."
"Nice to meet you, Mr. President," Tony says, extending his hand. "Tony Michaels."
"Frank Frost," Frank says, extending his hand and looking bored. "Don't mind me," Whitey says, when Ritchie looks her way. "I'm a hostage."
"Torque this baby," Rife says to the pilot. "Let's go to L.A. We got a mission to control."
The pilot has an angular face that, after her experiences on the raft, YT recognizes as typically Russian. He starts dicking with his controls. The engines whine louder, and the thwacking of the chopper blades picks up. YT feels but does not hear a couple of small explosions. Everyone else feels it too, but only Tony reacts. He crouches down on the floor of the chopper, pulls a gun out from under his jacket, and opens the door on his side. Meanwhile, the engines sigh back down in pitch, and the rotor coasts back down to an idle. YT can see him out the window. It's Hero. He's all covered with smoke and blood, and he's holding a pistol in one hand. He's just fired a couple of shots in the air to get their attention, and now he backs behind one of the parked choppers, taking cover.
"You're a dead man," Rife shouts. "You're stuck on the raft, asshole. I got a million myrmidons here. You gonna kill them all?"
"Swords don't run out of ammo," Hero shouts.
"Well, what do you want?"
"I want the tablet. You give me the tablet, then you can take off and let your million wireheads kill me. You don't give me the tablet, I'm gonna empty this clip into the windshield of your chopper."
"It's bulletproof," Rife says.
"No, it isn't," Hero says, "as the rebels in Afghanistan found out."
"He is right," the pilot says.
"Fucking Soviet piece of shit.
They put all that steel in its belly and then made the windshield out of glass?"
"Give me the tablet," Hero says, "or I'm taking it."
"No, you ain't," Rife says, "'cause I got Tinkerbell here."
At the last minute, YT tries to duck down and hide so he won't see her. She's ashamed. But Hero locks eyes with her for just a moment, and she can see the defeat come into his face. She makes a dive for the door and gets halfway out under the downblast of the rotors. Tony grabs her coverall's collar and hauls her back inside. He shoves her down on her belly and puts one knee in the small of her back to hold her there. Meanwhile, the engine is powering up again, and out the open door she can see the steel horizon of the carrier's deck drop from view. After all this time, she fucked up the plan. She owes Hero a refund. Or maybe not. She puts the heel of one hand against the edge of the clay tablet and shoves as hard as she can. It slides across the floor, teeters on the threshold, and spins out of the chopper. Another delivery made. Another satisfied customer. For a minute or so, the chopper hovers 20 feet overhead. All the people inside are staring down at the tablet, which has burst out of its wrappings in the middle of the bullseye. The plastic has torn apart around the corners, and fragments, large fragments of the tablet, have sprayed out for a few feet in either direction. Hero stares at it too, still safe behind the cover of a parked chopper.
He stares at it so hard that he forgets to stare at anything else. Then a couple of wire heads land on his back, smashing his face into the flank of the chopper. He slides down and lands on his belly. His gun arm is still free, but a couple more wire heads sit on that. A couple on his legs, too. He can't move at all. He can't see anything but the broken tablet 20 feet away on the flight deck. The sound and wind of Rife's chopper diminish into a distant puttering noise that takes a long time to go away completely. He feels a tingling behind his ear, anticipating the scalpel and the drill. These wire heads are operating under remote control from somewhere else. Ing seemed to think that they had an organized RAF defense system. Maybe there's a hacker in charge, an N, sitting in the Enterprise's control tower, moving these guys around like an air traffic controller. In any case, they are not very big on spontaneity. They sit on him for a few minutes before they decide what to do next. Then, many hands reach down and clasp him around the wrists and ankles, elbows and knees. They haul him across the flight deck like pallbearers face up. Hero looks up into the control tower and sees a couple of faces looking down at him. One of them, the N, is talking into a microphone. Eventually, they come to a big flat elevator that sinks down into the guts of the ship, out of view of the control tower. It comes to rest on one of the lower decks, apparently a hangar deck where they used to maintain airplanes. Hero hears a woman's voice speaking words gently but clearly. Melulu mualnu umnemki memenlulumu mealnu umnealnu umeme meme mululu elulu medugamu mumuleyalu eme. It's 3 feet straight down to the deck, and he covers the distance in free fall, slamming down on his back, bumping his head. All his limbs bounce loosely on the metal. Around him he sees and hears the wire heads collapsing like wet towels falling off a rack. He cannot move any part of his body. He has a little control over his eyes. A face comes into view, and he has trouble resolving it, can't quite focus, but he recognizes something in her posture, the way she tosses her hair back over her shoulder when it falls down. It's Juanita. Juanita, with an antenna rising out of the base of her skull. She kneels down beside him, bends down, cups one hand around his ear, and whispers. The hot air tickles his ear. He tries to move away from it, but can't. She's whispering another long string of syllables. Then she straightens up and gooses him in the side. He jerks away from her. "Get up, lazy bones," she says. He gets up. He's fine now. But all the wire heads lay around him, perfectly motionless. "Just a little nam shub I whipped up," she says. "They'll be fine." "Hi," he says. "Hi. It's good to see you, Hero. I'm going to give you a hug now. Watch out for the antenna." She does. He hugs her back. The antenna's upside his nose, but that's okay. "Once we get this thing taken off, all the hair and stuff should grow back," she whispers. Finally, she lets him go. "That hug was really more for me than for you. It's been a lonely time here. Lonely and scary." This is typically paradoxical behavior for Juanita, getting touchy-feely at a time like this. "Don't get me wrong," Hero says, "but aren't you one of the bad guys now?" "Oh, you mean this?" "Yeah. Don't you work for them?" "If so, I'm not doing a very good job," she laughs, gesturing at the ring of motionless wireheads. "No, this doesn't work on me. It sort of did for a while, but there are ways to fight it." "Why? Why doesn't it work on you?" "I've spent the last several years hanging around with Jesuits," she says. "Look, your brain has an immune system just like your body. The more you use it, the more viruses you get exposed to, the better your immune system becomes. And I've got a hell of an immune system. Remember, I was an atheist for a while, and then I came back to religion the hard way." "Why didn't they screw you up the way they did David?"
"I came here voluntarily."
"Like Inanna?"
"Yes."
"Why would anyone come here voluntarily?"
"Hero, don't you realize? This is it. This is the nerve center of a religion that is at once brand new and very ancient.
Being here is like following Jesus or Muhammad around, getting to observe the birth of a new faith. But it's terrible. Rife is the Antichrist, Hero says.
Of course he is, but it's still interesting.
And Rife has got something else going for him. Eridu,
the city of Enki, Hero says.
Exactly. He's got every tablet Enki ever wrote. For a person who's interested in religion and hacking, this is the only place in the world to be. If those tablets were in Arabia, I'd put on a chador and burn my driver's license and go there. But the tablets are here, and so I let them wire me up instead.
So all this time, your goal was to study Enki's tablets.
To get the Mei, just like Inanna. What else?
And have you been studying them?
Oh, yes.
And?
She points to the fallen wireheads. And I can do it now. I'm a Baal Shem. I can hack the brainstem.
Okay, look. I'm happy for you, Juanita. But at the time being, we have a little problem. We are surrounded by a million people who want to kill us. Can you paralyze all of them?
Yes, she says. But then they die.
You know what we have to do, don't you, Juanita?
Release the Namshub of Enki, she says. Do the babble thing.
Let's go get it, Hero says.
First things first, Juanita says. The control tower.
Okay. You get ready to grab the tablet, and I'll take out the control tower.
How are you going to do that? By cutting people up with swords?
Yeah. That's the only thing they're good for.
Let's do it the other way around, Juanita says.
She gets up and walks off across the hangar deck. The Namshub of Enki is a tablet wrapped up in a clay envelope covered with the cuneiform equivalent of a warning sticker. The entire assembly has shattered into dozens of pieces. Most of them have stayed wrapped up inside the plastic, but some have gone spinning across the flight deck. Hero gathers them up from the helipad and returns them to the center. By the time he's got the plastic wrapper cut away, Juanita is waving to him from the windows on top of the control tower. He takes all the pieces that look to be part of the envelope and puts them into a separate pile. Then he assembles the remains of the tablet itself into a coherent group. It's not obvious yet how to piece them together, and he doesn't have time for jigsaw puzzles. So he goggles into his office, uses the computer to take an electronic snapshot of the fragments, and calls the librarian.
Yes, sir.
This hypercard contains a picture of a shattered clay tablet. Do you know of some software that would be good at piecing it back together?
One moment, sir, the librarian says.
Then a hypercard appears in his hand. He gives it to Hero. It contains a picture of an assembled tablet.
That's how it looks, sir.
Can you read Sumerian?
Yes, sir.
Can you read this tablet out loud?
Yes, sir.
Get ready to do it. And hold on a second. Hero walks over to the base of the control tower. There's a door there that gives him access to a stairwell. He climbs up to the control room, a strange mixture of Iron Age and high-tech. Juanita's waiting there, surrounded by peacefully slumbering wireheads. She taps a microphone that is projecting from a communications panel at the end of a flexible gooseneck. The same mic that the N was speaking into.
Live to the raft, she says. Go for it.
Hero puts his computer into speakerphone mode and stands up next to the microphone. Librarian, read it back, he says. And a string of syllables pours out of the speaker. In the middle of it, Hero glances up at Juanita. She's standing in the far corner of the room with her fingers stuck in her ears. Down at the base of the stairs, a wirehead begins to talk. Deep down inside the Enterprise, there's more talking going on. And none of it makes any sense. It's just a lot of babbling. There's an external catwalk on the control tower. Hero goes out there and listens to the raft. From all around them comes a dim roar, not of waves or wind, but of a million unchained human voices speaking in a confusion of tongues. Juanita comes out to listen, too. Hero sees a trickle of red under her ear.
You're bleeding, he says.
I know. A little bit of primitive surgery, she says. Her voice is strained and uncomfortable. I've been carrying around a scalpel blade for cases like this.
What did you do?
Slit it up under the base of the antenna and cut the wire that goes into my skull.